You are listening to a sermon series from Open Door Fellowship Church.
Good morning, Open Door. Okay, that was it was not as solid as the worship was. You guys didn't pace yourself well. I need more. So let's just say it. Good morning, everyone. All right. Thank you. Maybe not that much more. Hey, we're in Ecclesiastes, Life Worth Living. And I am loving this series. Thank you for bringing your friends. This is beautiful. I see some people I've never seen before. So this is delightful. Ecclesiastes, somewhere in the middle of your Bible, just keep fiddling around. You'll find it's after Proverbs, before Isaiah. And we're in chapter 7. And it starts out, Solomon is trying to explain, I think I've come to understand what a good name comes from. I think I'm starting to understand where you get a good name from. And he says, a good name is better than good ointment, better than the best perfume, better than anything, whatever that most savory, beautiful, expensive, sense-inspiring ointment or fragrance that you can imagine, a good name is sweeter and better and stronger and more beautiful. And he's going to talk about, and I tell you what, I would have never guessed that this is where he would have gone. I would have never guessed what he's going to say next. After reading a good name, and this is how you're going to get it, what he comes up with next blows my mind. But I have wanted ever since I came to Christ to have a good name so that when I left this planet, you'd be sad that I left and that you would be able to say, God, he had a life that we won't be able to replace that. And that's a good, right thing. And then you can twist it a little bit and get it unhealthy. That would be what Randy Thompson and I did. Some of you, I realize, don't even know who Randy Thompson is. He was our worship pastor for the longest time, one of our best friends, and just a delightful, delightful man. Put out a bunch of music, and if you haven't listened to it, you should listen to all of it. But anyways, he and I had this friendship, and we talked about it one day of thinking, man, whoever goes first, whoever dies, the other one has to really promote the other's good name. I mean, I want you in that memorial service to get people to laud me. I mean, really go after it, to really praise me. And so each of us, because, you know, we'll be seeing it from heaven, we'll just get to watch this. And I was hoping, man, I'd like to go first. I would like to hear that. Wouldn't that be just so great? And so we'd laugh about it all the time of thinking, okay, you have to literally get people up on their feet, get them making up stories, whatever they have to do to publicly laud you. And anyway, one night we were over at Ran Mazingo's house out in wherever they live, like Ohio, wherever they are. And we're sitting around his campfire, and Randy and I are telling, we're so impressed with ourselves about this plan and this, and we tell the whole thing, and Rand's laughing, and I said, so, Rand, do you have anyone like that, you know, kind of that you'll do that with? And he says, no, I don't have anyone. In fact, I really don't want the service to say much about me. I just wanted to lift up the Lord Jesus. And Randy and I both just, well, yeah, I mean, well, for sure, that, you know, yeah, we want that whole thing going on. Maybe we'll have two services, one for a public lauding and the other for the Lord Jesus. And but still, there is something deeply innate in us to want our lives to have count. And Solomon today gives us that road. To have that legacy, that beautiful legacy of acquiring a good name. I told you about Ed Underwood. Every Sunday morning about 3:30, he writes a piece to Mark McCune and myself, and because he knows we're preaching. And he says, what can I pray for? What can I pray for? And so I said, Ed, I'm preaching a really hard passage today, and I'm scared of the tone of how I'll come across. I'm scared of just the difficulty of the things that will be in this message. And so he wrote, I'll be praying for you, John. Keep in mind that they will all live more of this life in the house of mourning, so they need this. The grace that has met me in the house of mourning has been the most precious to me. It's not showing off to talk about your own mourning over the impact of your disease. It will help them. I love you, John. And so here's the passage, at least the start of what I'm going to be hitting. A good name is better than good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Let's take hands and sing Kumbaya. Because that at the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart, sorrow is better than laughter. Sorrow is better than laughter. Gosh, for a guy who loves humor and laughter and playfulness and feasting, this is hard. He said, it makes an interesting statement, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. Even though I'm going through something that's so hard and difficult, inside God may be doing something so magnificently beautiful. So the mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. Let me give the first slide. Without some express thin comfort to others in grief by a slap on the back and a cliched one-liner about how it's all going to get better, so hang in there, buddy. And they attribute it to their personality. It's usually not personality. It's fear. It's fear to get close enough to another human to be able to enter in meaningful to their pain. It's fear to wade through their hurt and fear and anger. It's fear that we won't know what to say, or that we'll say something wrong or stupid. Fear to be so authentically known by another. Such is not befitting who we are in Christ. Galatians 6:2 teaches what we get to do, the one thing we get to do, the one thing we are known for is that we love each other. And Galatians 6:2 says, the way I do that is I enter into and I stay. This is what love looks like in action. This is what believers get to do. Now, not for everybody and not all the time, but each of us have been given some. See, believers, we get to laugh and enjoy with the best of them. But we are at our very best wearing the clothing of our new natures in the rooms of grief and sorrow and loss and hopelessness and fear and desperation. Gosh, it makes no sense. Gosh, when you first read this thing, better to go into the house of mourning, sorrows better than laughter. So many of us have it backwards. It forces us to confess that. We rush to amusement as though it's going to fill our souls, and we fear facing grief as though it will destroy us. We honor the beginning of things more than the fragile, revealed, imperfect people who have become real and proven. And we see very little value or purpose in hard seasons. Instead, we try to create our own carelessly easy seasons. And Solomon says, kid, I'm begging for you to understand this so you can have a good name. So at the end of your life, someone says, gosh, I don't know what I'm going to do now that they're off this planet. Apparently, a good name, Solomon says, is formed in trusting God to make sense of the pain and sorrow and injustice and mourning that we cannot control. So I want this, but it scares us, right? It scares me. It scares me a lot to dare run this risk. Remember I talked to you about Mark Appleman, my stepbrother, and his wife who's lost her life. And Mark, the first thing I asked him when I got to see him in Dallas, I said, "How you doing? Who have you been able to process this with anyone?" And he said these words, "I have this fear that if I start processing grief, I will fall apart and I won't be able to come back. I'm afraid that if I allow myself to enter into the sadness that I know is there, I won't be able to come back." They say that's why women cry in real time and men cry at beer commercials. I stuff pain like no one I know. I've proven too many times how overwhelmed I am in trying to enter another's loss. But God's teaching me. I do not like the way He is teaching me. This morning, my feet are killing me, and it's so ironic. It's the very thing that created the pain that allowed God to be teaching me in this season. Once you've faced incredible, unresolvable loss, you get wiser over what another truly needs in pain. I wouldn't have been able to make any sense of this 15 years ago. I would have had to preach it from rote. I wouldn't have understood. But lost, you get wiser over what another truly needs in pain. For they feel lonely, estranged, outside, behind, and afraid. I didn't know this was the unspoken collateral damage of grief and loss and unremitting pain. I didn't know. And now I am no longer as afraid to enter the house of mourning. I long to stand with such to remind them who they really are. That pain does not define them. That they are heroic. That they are vital and needed, maybe even more now than ever in this community. And when I am there and when I get to do that, it reminds me who I really am. Christ in me. So Solomon, after 15 years of disuse, gets to come back and use the form of a proverb. He says, "I'm just going to use a series of proverbs now, and I'm going to be talking about something that's better than another thing. To do this is better than to do this." And by saying that, he's not saying this is bad or necessarily wrong. He's just saying this is better. So 8 times in here, he'll say, this is better. He's not devaluing laughter or humor or festivity or getting together and hanging out and playing just for the sake of playing. He created that. He created laughter and humor. It's just this, that Solomon is describing a sorrow that is redemptive. And maybe in these cases, a laughter and a feasting which avoids and masks real life. Does that make sense? So he's not talking about the best that laughter is coming from a meaningful situation. He's talking about that comes from trying to mask and cover what is really happening. So let's take a look at an outline to process this through. So first, verses 1 through 6, what we just looked at, to process grief is better than chasing thin amusement. Secondly, then, in verses 7 through 9, to allow anger at the injustice of oppressors. Oh, gosh, he's going to talk in a second. He's going to say, oppression's going to happen, injustice is going to happen, and you should hate it. But don't let it make you go crazy. Don't let it have you mistrust God, because what you'll do is you'll start giving yourself the permission to protect yourself. You'll start cheating. You'll start cutting corners. You'll be open to bribes. So he's saying to allow anger at the injustice of oppressors, it can corrupt your heart. Careful. Because that good name, I don't want you to get sick. Third, to celebrate a proven good name is better than an untested beginning. And then finally, oh, I love this. I love Solomon is the wisest man in the world because he creates an outline that's so beautifully logical and ordered. To find value in each season allows you to really live. And then he'll show God. God will show up again for Solomon. He'll get up on top of the tapestry and be able to see wisdom again. So let's look at the first one. To process grief is better than chasing amusement. Wow, why is the day of one's death better than the day of one's birth? Because you should have never been born and we're glad you're gone? No. Think about it. We get to celebrate best a lived out goodness over here at the end of one's life. We get to look at something that is worthwhile. Here it's just something that's crying with a weird cone head. We don't know what this is going to become at all. And so better is that day, better is the day of death and one's birth. We get to worship God's ability. God, you did it. You redeemed this person. We get to worship God's ability to redeem a life and make it count. We get to say, I was here for that. They were in my life. And so we get to thank God for getting to know a good person. So all of that's being tested. And when we leave this earth, oh gosh, one of the most sacred things I get to do, just on the being clergy, is that I get to do memorial services. I get to stand in front of a group of people, a community, a village of the people that were that person's influence. And I get to say, I'll leave before him, but I want to be able to say about this man, God, thank you. He lived out this life. Tim O'Reary lived out this life that you had for him, and we got to benefit from it. I got to benefit from it. Thank you, God. That day of our death is better than the day of our birth, because we get it's filled with truth and fragileness and brokenness healed, and beauty, and getting to tell what life's really about. We will actually be in pain because that person so wonderfully lived out sacrifice and heroism because they had a good name. Why is it better to enter the house of mourning than the house of feasting? Now, one, it reveals who you are. And secondly, there's a lot more to be learned in the house of mourning than the house of feasting. Standing with the needy and the suffering who have lost, than to just sit around and eat. Now, these are hard words for me because I'm a foodie. I love food and beverage and being with people and just celebrating on our back patio. I can't think of much more that the Lynches love to do than that. But there is something, it has to be in the context of something. If it's just that to do that, it's covering. Oh, but to be able to, I get to stand for others in the midst of life's most important work in the house of mourning. It's the most important thing we can do is to process grief and to hold each other in sadness and confusion. I get to stand for others in the midst of that. All of us can who have learned this lesson. I learn how to comfort. I can't learn how to comfort outside the house of mourning. When he's talking about the house of mourning, he's not talking about a funeral home. He's talking about wherever we gather to process the life of a person. I learn how to be comforted. I best learn the value of life in the pain of its passing. And I'm taught to value my days because they're few. One of the beautiful things of doing a memorial service, I go, man, this thing isn't forever. Isn't that one of the greatest lies that life tells us, is that we're all just going to kind of be here forever. It's not ever going to happen to us. People do die, but we don't die. We do. I have a little time left on this earth, and I want it to count. I want to beautifully get to love those who are given to me. I don't want to miss this. The house of mourning teaches me that. I'm compelled to value the questions of eternity in mourning. I discover my need for a God who is eternal, who alone can make sense of life. I find the best in others when they are not in control. Isn't that true? When you're around people and they've lost their ability to control things, aren't they absolutely lovable to you? And I find the best in others when they're not superficial. And I find the best in myself when I'm needed to offer comfort. And I discover the best in my God because I need Him most in those times where I can't make sense of it. Why sorrow better than laughter? Any fool can laugh. That verse in there that says, like thorns in a underneath a pot by a fire that's boiling up to make water boil. You hear the of thorns just popping. It's nothingness. Any fool can laugh. But it takes a lover to enter into someone's pain. And because while I'm sufficient in laughter, God is needed in sorrow. And because laughter, unless it's tied to meaning, it's just superficial. And sorrow causes me to need you, which I don't want to have to do. And sorrow causes you to remember your need of me. And have you noticed that laughter without meaning, it devolves into hurtful humor at somebody else's expense? And God beautifully comforts the sorrowful in their need-filled trust. So that's why sorrow is better than laughter. So he says, do you see a good name being formed? It's being formed in the house of mourning where you become a lover instead of a taker. Okay, I want to keep talking to you about a good name, Solomon says. So let me go on to the next thing. He says, secondly, why would I ever listen to a rebuke from a wise or a fool? It doesn't matter. Gosh, verse 5, look at that. It's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to the song of fools. What if I like the song of fools? I like being told that I'm great and everything. This is the way he says, rebuke. What a hard thing for me to read. Rebuke literally is to express sharp disapproval or criticism because of their behavior or action. Adjectives are scold, admonish, reprove, berate, chastise. It is better for someone, even if they do it inappropriately, even if they do it with the wrong motive, if they are a wise person, take it. They're offering you a gift. I want you to hear, this is for John Lynch, maybe one of my greatest weaknesses. It's been very hard for me to take critique from people I know who are for me. But if someone is hurtful in it, and my good name has developed much more slowly because my shame is terrified of letting someone speak rebuke to me. And so I fight against it, and I won't take it, and I won't listen to it, and I guard myself against it. And here Solomon says it's better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than to listen to the song of fools. This was written for me. If it is about you at all, it's just because you got in the way. This is not telling you to take abuse. But some of us will not allow trusted friends to tell us the truth that we desperately need to hear. Now, they will do it clumsily. But if I do not allow the wounds of a friend, eventually they stop trying and learn to tiptoe around me and my issues. Raise your hand if you know anyone like that. Yeah. Raise your hand if it's me. No, don't, please. That came so quickly. That was not good. No. Yeah. See, a fool can tell you what you'd like to hear, and you become self-deceived. And if I wait for perfectly packaged constructive criticism, it might not ever come. The wise person is offering me a great gift in their rebuke, even if they don't know how to do it right. And if I demand only affirmation and uplifting, carefully done correction, people will learn it's not safe to correct me, and I will become self-referencing, and my good name will be slow to form. I wonder if Solomon learned this from his dad, David. One of the most precious places in Scripture to watch a hero live out heroism is in one of the most surprising places where you'd never expect to see it happen. David has just lost the kingdom to his son Absalom, who has learned to hate his dad and sleeps now in broad daylight on top of the roof. He sleeps with David's wives. It's so sick. And David now, with his tail between his legs, has had to run off away from the battle. And he's with the mighty men, these heroes, these men's men who have followed him but probably are wondering, did we pick the right guy? And some of his generals are with him. And meanwhile, there is, up on a bluff that's running parallel to David, there is this man who shows up and starts cursing at David and starts throwing rocks at him and blowing dust at him. He must be close enough that dust can be thrown, but it's such a fascinating story. It's about this very truth and about God's sovereignty in the midst of it. When King David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out a man from the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera, and he came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, and all the people and the mighty men who were at his right hand and at his left. And Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless man. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son, Absalom. And behold, you're taken in your own evil. You're a man of bloodshed. And he kept throwing the stones. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, hey, look, come on, because this looks bad for all of them to continue this. So it's more about the shame of this other guy. He says, why would we let this dead dog curse my lord, the king? Come on, let me go over and cut his head off. And all the rest of the mighty men, I'm sure, going, yes, let we all cut his head off. And the king said, what do I have to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord's told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Then David said to Abishai and to all of his servants, behold, My son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? Let him alone. Let him alone. Let him curse. For the Lord has told him, perhaps the Lord will look at my affliction and return good to me instead of his cursing this day. So David and his men, they went on their way, and Shammai went along the hillside parallel to him. And as he went, he kept cursing and kept casting stones and threw dust at him. And the king and all the people, they were not allowed to touch this man. They had to just keep getting stones thrown at them. And David getting stones. It says they arrived weary, but then he was refreshed when he got there. David allowed God's sovereignty to rule, not his own. David could have had that man killed that day in a second. Any of the mighty men were begging to do it. David said, no, I know what's happening here. I'll trust my God. I will allow the rebuke, even of an unwise man, of a man who hates me. God has me covered. And if I fight against it and I power up and I try to say, no, 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 you don't get to do this. You will not embarrass me in front of my men. God can't protect the proud, but he can protect the humble. What a beautiful lesson. And I wonder if Solomon learned that from his own dad. So he keeps going. He says, to allow anger at the injustice of oppressors, it can corrupt your heart and rob your good name. So in verses 7 through 9, he says, for oppression makes a wise man like crazy, and a bribe then can corrupt his heart. For the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. So don't be eager in your heart to get angry, because angry resides in the bosom of fools. He's saying, I know what's going to happen. You're going to see oppression and injustice. And it will feel like God's not in control. It will make you crazy. God, you're supposed to judge oppression and injustice, and you're not doing it. He says, careful. That anger is going to leave you open to a lot of madness. It's going to allow you to consider a bribe. It's going to allow you to cheat. It's going to allow you to turn corners because you think there's no one protecting you, and so you have to self-protect. So he says, be very, very careful. Oppression can cause me to lose hope in justice and makes me open to self-protect and more receptive to things like bribes. And then anger, it never allows me the patience so I can become objective. So I'm always in this subjective mode, and where I can hurt people, and where my good name starts to get thinned. And anger, it says, it creates, and at the same time, it reveals foolishness. So be so, so wise, Solomon says. I played this stupid game. Third, to celebrate a proven name is better than untested beginnings. I love what he says. Don't say, hey, why is it that the former days were better than these? It's not from wisdom that you ask about this. Wisdom along with an inheritance is good and advantage to those who see the sun. If all you're going to do is live for underneath the sun, then it'd be good to have an inheritance. For wisdom is protection just as money is protection, but the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. What I really want to hit here is simply this thought. When we think the good old days were better, we get deceived. There were no good old days. You ever watch the movie Midnight in Paris? If you haven't, leave now and go see it on Netflix. Just why are you here? But it's a great story. Woody Allen, Owen Wilson's characters, it displays that every generation thinks the generation before them were the good old days. So I think about our good old days. When I was a kid, the good old days, and I'm thinking, those days when blacks couldn't vote, when men could legally hit their wives, when children were driven around with no seatbelts, when we had bomb drills under our desks, when there were no treatments for cancer, when hazing was standard behavior in fraternities and sport teams, when people could smoke next to you on an airplane, when disco reigned? Are these the good old days we're talking about? Yeah. He says, for those whose passion is only under the sun, you'd better hope you get an inheritance. And wisdom and knowledge, they do have value even for those under the sun, because at least can help your inheritance and meaningful quality of life when you get it. And then he says, okay, now I want to tell you what has happened. And for a moment, Solomon gets out of the weeds and out from those jangled threads of all the colors that don't make sense, and suddenly gets on top of the tapestry and says, okay, I'm going to tell you what I've learned. And this is so humbling of Solomon, because he spent so many years, like 15, trying to find a different answer, and he couldn't. And so he says, you want a good name? Then consider the work of God. Verse 13. Consider, just stop. Consider the work of God. Consider how beautiful he is and how right he is. He makes the statement right after that. Who's able to straighten what he's bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. These insights come out of this. Man cannot straighten what has been bent by God. And only God can straighten that which is bent in my own life. Nobody can change what God has done. And only God has the power to straighten my brokenness. It makes me shudder. It makes me overwhelmed. It makes me say, I consider the work of God. I can't play in those stupid games. I can't mask pain, and I can't let injustice and such just make me angry and make me quit and make me say I get to take life on my own terms and self-protect and cheat and steal and rob. Consider the work of God. Man can't straighten what is bent by God, and only God can bring redemption to brokenness. And God is so all good, so that you can be convinced that his will and purposes are right, even in the seasons that seem random and chaotic. That's what he says in verse 14. In the day of prosperity, go ahead, be happy. But in the day of adversity, just know that God's made the one as well as the other. And then he says, God builds in the need for dependence through adversity. So you can't claim you figured out life by yourself. He says, just when you think you got me figured out, shoo, that happened. I didn't see that happening. He says, I'm filling your life with things that catch you off guard even, so that you never go, oh, I finally got this figured out. No, you need God. You know the one that caught me off guard most? This. Jesus Christ. I never could have put that together, that God the Father would allow the story of his own son being killed and mocked and left for dead and have it turn out to be the most beautiful story of ever. I never saw it coming. I never saw the resurrection coming. I never saw a new world coming. He has caught me off guard. He continually keeps me off guard. And I'm actually starting to believe it and trust it. I'm letting other people speak into my life. I'm letting those who rebuke me, who are wise, I'm going ahead and letting it happen, because I want a good name. I want to consider this God who is totally in control, who knows me, who made me, is not ashamed of me, who delights in me, who has planned for me, who will not make mistakes regarding me. And I'm letting him run my world. When I think about this process, I've watched it in front of me, I realize, in the Martins. Dennis Martin, Cindy Martin, Kristen Martin Nunley, and Michael Martin. I'm related to them, and Dennis and Cindy lost their son, David, to suicide when he was young. And I watched it devastate them. And I watched them in the house of mourning, and I watched their sadness. And I watched, over time, this gradual thing take place that I thought it was always going to be tragic. And then I've watched, and studied their lives, and I see redemption and healing and beauty. And I look at their lives. They will always spend disproportionate time in the house of mourning. But you know what two things I've seen about them? When I want a good time and I want to go play, you know who I like to hang out with? Dennis. Dennis, Mike, all of them, but I really like hanging out with Dennis. Because he understands death and he understands life. You know what else they do? They hang out a lot in the house of mourning. You could see them at any gathering, any party. They gravitate to those who are in need. They gravitate to the hurting. So Solomon says, you guys, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, you guys. You won't go in and not be able to come out. This is sacred, you guys. He has you covered. Don't be afraid. There's going to be plenty of laughter. We're going to get plenty of joy on this planet. But this is the start of a really, really good name. So that when you leave this planet, I'll say, I wish they were still here. I don't know how I do life right now without them.